From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a small tablet, a strawberry-flavored pill. The pill's medical name is dolutegravir, but most people who need it will describe it by what it is. HIV medication for babies. As the New York Times reported yesterday, this is welcome news in the fight against HIV and AIDS. Every year, roughly 160,000 children become infected with HIV. Most of the time, that happens at birth or through breastfeeding when their mothers do not realize that they themselves are infected. And babies do not like the bitter taste of most medications. Creating a dissolvable berry-flavored option helps tens of thousands of infants. And without treatment, half of those babies would die by age 2, as the Times reports. Another 80% will not survive to age 5. Most HIV deaths in young children happen in Africa, but not all. And on World AIDS Day, this is just one piece of progress. There's more we could talk about. The World Health Organization confirmed today that after many years of research, it has approved a vaginal insert designed to protect women against HIV infection. But in some ways, all of these news stories, these small victories, were supposed to be unnecessary by now, particularly in New York State. Back in 2014, Governor Andrew Cuomo created a task force called ETE, Ending the Epidemic, focused on the near elimination of HIV/AIDS in New York State. The target deadline was the year 2020. Here we are, of course. A new pandemic has made everything more complicated, including dealing with HIV/AIDS. And as we learn more about COVID, there are some parallels, but some stark differences. Back in the 1980s, there was hope that we'd have an AIDS vaccine before too long. Well, despite years of research, we're still waiting. And this particular vaccine has proven to be extremely difficult to achieve. It's a very different story with COVID, of course, with the approval of several vaccines already on the horizon, with medical science going from zero to a vaccine in less than 1 year. Why is HIV so difficult to narrow down with a vaccine? What's different about it? What have we learned about the AIDS pandemic that is applicable to the coronavirus pandemic we're dealing with? And is ETE, ending the epidemic when it comes to AIDS, still achievable? Let's talk about that with our guests. This hour, we welcome Dr. Bill Valenti, Senior Vice President for Strategic Advancement, Chief of Innovation, and Co-Founder and Staff Physician at Trillium Health. Dr. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon. Hi.
Nice to have you. Nice to have David Henderson, playwright of Unfinished Business, which we're going to be talking about coming up. Hi, David. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Shepard is a prevention navigator at Trillium Health. Andrew, welcome to you as well.
Hello.
There is an event coming up on Saturday, which we're going to talk about in a moment coming up here. But Dr. Valenti, you know, it's interesting. I just got off a call this morning with doctors who producer Megan Mack and I were talking to, because in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a WXXI live televised forum about vaccines for COVID, all about vaccines. And they are coming, and they are coming, I mean, rapidly, given comparisons to just about anything. And that's going to be educational. But here we are in 2020, still no HIV vaccine. And I know you and I've talked about this, but is that hard for the public to understand that some viruses, you can do this, you can crack that code in a matter of months or years, and others are sort of a moving target that you never feel like you can really land on?
Yeah, it is a hard concept to understand. And one of the key things there is that we're really talking about two very different viruses in terms of how they're transmitted and how they enter the body and how they behave. So that's a big difference. On the other hand, this mRNA technology used by the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines might be applicable to HIV. So it may be something that's been hiding in plain sight. So we learn from our pandemics. They teach us something about other diseases that may help us move the needle.
Yeah, and interesting reading just this morning about a Chinese doctor who in January published viral sequence. And so in January, with the publication of the sequence from a Chinese doctor, you had kind of the blueprint. And 2 days later, Moderna had written up their own plans for an mRNA vaccine that is now going to come to fruition. I mean, that is hard to get our heads around. But when you say something new, that it's essentially something new here, Bill, with mRNA, what do you mean by that?
What you do is you take little fingerprints of virus, not live virus, but just enough to stimulate the immune system to react and fight back when it's exposed to that virus. So it's a new technology, and one of the reasons is why this has gone so quickly is because you can take these little snippets of genetic material, turn it into vaccine quickly, and test it quickly. So this is really unprecedented. This is a huge, huge scientific advance. And hopefully we're going to learn something about it, about that science, and apply it to other disease states.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of optimism that if it works here, maybe it works with other viruses. Why has HIV in particular been so difficult? Is there something about it, Bill, that has just made it very difficult?
Well, two things. One is that it mutates very aggressively, quickly, and in large amounts, much more so than the COVID virus. And the other is that the vaccines that have been used have used older technologies and not something like mRNA. So we're going to learn from this.
Yeah, and I know I've asked you this before, but I'm going to keep asking you. You know, for listeners who haven't heard you kind of describe maybe the, how your mindset's changed, were you thinking by the time maybe we moved into the 1990s, were you thinking a vaccine was coming for HIV? And at this point, decades later, is it your expectation we will have one eventually?
We will have one eventually. But I always add 10 years to my timeline simply because the first 20 years with this have been so difficult with so many false starts. I'd say, though, if there's something like that mRNA technology out there that we can apply to HIV, it might move faster after this.
Talking to Dr. Bill Valenti from Trillium, who they've got a big event coming up on Saturday, which we're excited to talk about. And, you know, you wish the circumstances were different because this has been a hard year for all the obvious reasons for the medical community. And so you had this goal, 2020 ETE, ending the epidemic, certainly an ambitious goal. And Dr. Valenti, if you could, why don't you describe what that goal really entailed? Because obviously it wouldn't have meant zero people with HIV or zero people with AIDS or zero new cases. But what was kind of the goal when you go back 5-6 years ago that maybe the governor and the team had set for New York State by 2020?
The big goal is stop the spread of HIV, stop the spread of virus. And the way to do that, there are 3 points. One is more testing, identify people who are HIV positive, get them into care, treat them with these new drugs that help stop the spread of virus. And then for people who are HIV negative but at risk, give them what we call PrEP or pre-exposure one pill a day that is 99% effective in terms of stopping the spread of virus. So we're going to break the curve and decrease the number of new infections. Now, what's happened is numbers reported this morning because there's a World AIDS Day conference in Albany for New York State going on right now, is that we've reduced the number of new infections from 50,000 a year at the peak of the epidemic to well under 2,000 statewide. So we have seen some progress. We've had a little bit of a bump in Monroe County with new infections, but overall this and the epidemic program, this three-part program, has been very effective at getting people's attention, getting them into care, and helping stop the spread of HIV. So that's it. Now, the pandemic, of course, changes everything.
Yeah, and for this community, what's been the hardest part to deal with during the pandemic, Dr. Valenti?
Well, staying in touch with people. So we've really made a huge effort. The Trillium philosophy is, okay, if we can't do it in the office, then we'll go to where people are. So we have pharmacy deliveries, at-home HIV testing kits, and video visits. I'm doing all of my patient care by video. So we managed to turn that around in a very short period of time. And the other thing is, at the same time, while we were doing that, going to video and home deliveries, also opened up a COVID testing program. So it's been a lot of work in a short period of time, but the idea is we want to continue the commitment that we've made, which is test, treat, prevent.
And I've got just one more question I want to ask you about as we look at sort of the newer pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, and the impact on the fight against AIDS, the efforts for ending the epidemic, and maybe how some of those efforts dovetail. It's interesting. The New York Times reported that there's been some controversy among some of the selections that President-elect Biden has made for his coronavirus. Essentially, it's a task force. It's a panel of medical experts and scientists and public speakers and people who can reach out to the community and communicate the science on this. One of the people on the task force for Biden-Harris is Dr. Eric Goosby, who was President Obama's global AIDS coordinator. And the New York Times reports that the criticism has been that, well, there hasn't been enough outreach. There should be more Republicans on this panel. There's too many holdovers from the Obama-Biden years, that there aren't enough parallels in AIDS and the coronavirus to really gain a lot from maybe the insight. I'm just curious to know what you think of the Biden-Harris team selecting someone like Dr. Goosby, who was a global AIDS coordinator under the Obama administration, if you think that's a wise choice now as we look at a different pandemic.
Yeah, I think it's a very good choice because Goosby has experience and he understands contagion. In other words, how infections are transmitted and what you do to stop it. Same thing with Mike Osterholm, Dr. Mike Osterholm from University of Minnesota, who's also in that group. I mean, really sharp people who get it. And I don't want to get political here, but since you brought it up.
Go ahead.
There have been some mixed messages coming out of the administration. The two people I'd keep an eye on who are currently there, Tony Fauci, a friend of 40 years who knows what he's talking about, and Dr. Deborah Birx. So I think he's got the core of a very good team. I think I'll stop there because I really want to stay away from the politics.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you one more question about that, but I'm not trying to push you in a direction of politics. I do want to ask you if you are concerned that just the way we communicate about infectious disease has become too politicized, generally speaking. In other words, is it too hard to get some people to buy in to basic medical science and guidelines if there's too much politics involved in those kind of conversations?
Yeah, when you're talking about something as complicated as contagion, because that is not a concept that's well understood by most people. So they look to their experts, people that you look up to give you a clear, consistent message. And the problem is that we've had mixed messages regarding everything from masks to herd immunity that complicate things for people so that, as a result, mask wearing becomes a political statement as opposed to a public health matter. And we need to get away from that because if we want to get ahead of this pandemic, we need to be pulling in the same direction. And I'm hoping that by bringing Fauci and Birx from the current task force into what's planned by the Biden administration, that we'll be able to get ahead of this fast-moving train as opposed to always being a little bit behind.
Yeah, indeed. Well, there's an event coming up on Saturday, 7 p.m. Saturday evening, and listeners, you can find it on the Friends of Trillium Health Facebook page, and we'll have links for you. You can watch it at Channel 1301 in the city of Rochester. It's going to be hosted by two superstars, Bill Valenti and Mrs. Kasia Davis. Bill Valenti, what makes you think you can hold a candle to Kasia Davis?
I can't. I never said I could, but I'm a good foil for her.
No, Mrs. Kasia Davis is a legend. Before I talk to your co-panelists, Why don't you give me a sense for how you see this evening's event here, which is an important one marking World AIDS Day, which was founded in 1988. It's an important event for Trillium and for our community. Tell us about what's happening on Saturday night, Bill.
It's a commemoration event. We're celebrating the past, the people who have come before us. I've learned something from each one of those patients who have died. People who are still here have taught me a huge amount and laid the groundwork for where we are today with talking about ending the epidemic. And then the future is really doing it, getting to zero. One of the interesting features is trying to communicate the message in a different way. Remember the book that I wrote in 2017? Well, we've adapted that to a reading or a play. It doesn't follow the book literally, but it speaks to the past, present, and the future in terms of getting the message out to people in a different platform to continue this commemoration. So, and of course, it's a fundraiser, so people are invited to make donations, of course. But the idea is to get the word out, increase awareness.
David Henderson is the playwright of Unfinished Business, and I want to bring in David to talk about how this did come together. It is based on Dr. Valenti's memoir, AIDS, A Matter of Urgency, as Bill just mentioned, published in 2017. How did you see the effort to bring it to sort of this kind of medium, David?
Well, Bill and I were introduced 2 years ago about this time. I was directing a reading of The Boys in the Band at the JCC, and apparently Bill had talked to Ralph Maranto about adapting the book for the stage. And so Ralph introduced us, and we've been working on it for about 2 years now. The main material for the play is the book, which details the amazing work that Bill and others did at Trillium, Steve Scheibel and so many others. But then we also wanted to look at the present, where we are now, and then what the future's like. So we did a lot of interviews with current staff, and we did a reading about a year ago that went really well, and we realized we still had some work to do. So we've been working on that, and we had hoped to have a reading of it in March, but we decided that we would go with the video for now. We wanted to present our work that we have. The play is just over an hour long, and we're presenting, I think, a quarter of that, so just over 12 or 13 minutes of the play we're performing on Saturday.
And for those who check it out on Saturday, David, you know, the script, the section that I was reading is, yeah, I mean, it's very much in the spirit of Bill's book. It's understanding what life was like and what sort of maybe those uncertain moments in the 1980s were like. What are some of the things that you want the audience to take away from seeing what they're going to see on Saturday night?
Well, you know, the biggest takeaway that I hope that they get is that, you know, we have been doing a lot of work for the last 20, 30 years now, going on to 40, and that our work is not done. The play is called Unfinished Business. There's one scene at the end that imagines what the future will be like when there's a vaccine for AIDS, when AIDS is an HIV, when HIV is no longer a health emergency that it is. We, you know, sometimes it's hard for us to continue on if we can't imagine what that future's like, and that's what I'm hoping comes out of this play.
Do you have a sense of optimism that that future is coming?
I do. I participated in a vaccine trial years ago, and the medicine that's out there is really fantastic. People are living much longer lives, you know, we are progressing. There is progression. We aren't regressing. So I definitely see optimism.
Yeah, I was reading before the program, one of the vaccine trials going back, I think, to 2009. I'm not sure when you were in one, David, but some of the questions that participants had before past trials were, at least to my reading, even more visceral and worried than the questions before the COVID vaccine trials. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know people who participated in COVID vaccine trials. There are people in this office who have participated, and there was a lot of optimism and excitement is the wrong word, but I think confidence that being in part of those vaccine trials this year would be a good idea, would be safe. When you go back and read comments from people about HIV vaccine trials, there was a lot of worry that, you know, are you making me a guinea pig? Why would you do this to me? This is, how do I know this will work? What are the adverse effects? What were your thoughts about that? Because, you know, clearly the medical community has made progress on this, even if they haven't achieved a final vaccine to the extent that there will be one. But there was just sort of a different mindset when I was reading. What was your mindset there?
Well, when I was in the trial, this was 2007, 2006, maybe even a little bit earlier. It was pretty early days of the trials. I was told pretty early on that the trial that I was taking part of was using a chicken cell to replicate HIV. So I was not concerned that I would get HIV. I had some other people around me who I had told about the trial that were concerned that even when I explained it, the comprehension was a little bit different. I don't know if it was because I got that firsthand directly from the nurse in the study, but at the time I felt very confident and, you know, it was very personal questions. We got very in-depth that, you know, that was a little bit harder, I think, for me than some of the other stuff.
At this point now, when you look at when you look back at the last 40 years, and particularly as a playwright adapting this work and putting together Unfinished Business, you know, it's such a different story than what the country and the world is currently so focused on with COVID. I mean, this thing, everything is happening with COVID sort of in a compressed timeline. And thank goodness. I mean, hopefully we're not that far away from kind of trying to make strides back towards what feels like normalcy. But does it feel to you, David, I mean, I get the idea that you're a little younger than Bill, not to date anybody here, but does it feel to you that there are people living with HIV, people who are becoming infected with HIV, and their mentality about it is very different given antivirals, given the quality of care and treatment as long as there's diagnosis, compared to the uncertainty of the 1980s?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I myself was diagnosed in 2010 with HIV and was, again, I don't know if it's my own confidence in the doctors that I've had or that I've had really wonderful doctors that I work with, that they ensured me that this was not the 80s, that there were drugs that were available that that are new and better and didn't have the same side effects. So that's 20 years later that I was diagnosed, and it's been 10 years now. And I don't have this fear. There was a short time when I was first diagnosed that I had a fear that I was going to die. It was irrational. I don't have that fear anymore. I have a fear that I'll die from other things, but not
How quickly did that fear go away for you?
For me, that took a while. That took a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a particularly, you know, difficult time, but it did take a while.
Okay. But Dr. Valenti, if I could bring you back in here, you know, you certainly can understand why anybody in David's position would fear dying. But at the same time, 2010 was a totally different landscape than 1985 or 1995. Can you just talk a little bit about that, Bill, about how the mindset that people infected with HIV have and how that has evolved over time?
Right. The early days we knew about HIV or we knew about AIDS because people were dying all the time. I mean, there are people that will talk to you about it. We went to funerals every week. So there was a real fear of death because it was all around us. And the war zone mentality of sudden illness, people in previously good health, sudden illness, dying very quickly, And many of them, your friends are in the same social network, was left a huge, huge impression and paved the way for discussions of safer sex and condom use and that sort of thing that was not part of the discussion prior to that. So, yeah, it left a huge, huge impression. There was a generation of people who were just wiped out.
Yeah.
And today it's a very different experience, especially if you're part of a generation that came along after the 90s, when things had settled down and drugs started to work better and people lived longer. But those early days left a huge impression of death, guilt, anxiety, and stigma that many people experience, but to a much, much lesser degree today.
Yeah, and I think, Bill, this year a lot of people have become sort of amateur epidemiologists and infection specialists, just given what we've all tried to learn about COVID and what happens if we get it. And what we've really learned are the two avenues of dealing with it are, well, obviously prevention is the starting, but vaccines and antivirals. And interestingly enough, this year we've seen a pretty good amount of progress in a short amount of time with COVID and antivirals, and different efforts and different sort of, I don't know if cocktail is the right word, but different sort of treatment approaches. And, you know, when I was reading in April and May, when medical systems were becoming overwhelmed with COVID, you had doctors, in some circumstances, getting pretty creative just to try to keep patients alive. And now we're learning more, and there's some more progress being made to understand why certain things are working, certain combinations of things working better than others. What was it like in the 1980s, especially when there was very little roadmap for what might work at mitigating an infection?
We always believed that early treatment was best and that combination therapy would work better than single drugs alone. Now, it took a long time in the AIDS community for people to accept that. But what I like about our current experience is that we seem to be learning a little bit faster from the past. In other words, the idea of more aggressive therapy, combination therapy or cocktails early in COVID seems to be coming together here. And that's a good thing. I don't think we need to wait 30 years to figure out how to treat COVID aggressively the way we did with HIV. Now, there are a lot of differences in terms of the diseases, how they work, and so on. But we should be able to move a lot faster. And Shakespeare said it best, what's past is prologue. In other words, learn from the past.
David, what's daily life like for you now?
Daily life for me now is fantastic. You know, I teach at MCC. I do work freelance projects on writing, and these days I've been doing a little bit of traveling, getting out of Rochester in the winter.
Talking to David Henderson, playwright of Unfinished Business, which is adapted from Bill Valenti's 2017 book. Dr. Bill Valenti is the Senior Vice President for Strategic Advancement, the Chief of Innovation, and co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. And after our only break, we're going to bring in Andrew Shepherd, a prevention navigator at Trillium Health, to hear Andrew's work and story as we take a look at the state of the AIDS epidemic 2020. It is World AIDS Day, and there were high hopes 5-6 years ago when New York State launched their ending the epidemic effort here. But COVID and the current pandemic with the coronavirus has made that more difficult, not impossible. There's an event on Saturday. They're going to have a lot of fun. Dr. Valenti and Mrs. Kasia Davis hosting. There's going to be a reading of part of Unfinished Business and a lot more fun and community spirit going on this unusual way of celebrating the work that Trillium is doing. We'll tell you more about that and continue the conversation after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with Indigenous artists about their work that's on display now through Ganondagin. We'll tell you how you can see it, but perhaps even more importantly, we're talking about anti-racist education in action and whether it includes indigenous peoples. Are Native Americans included when we talk about anti-racism? And if not, why? We discuss it with them next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andrew Shepherd is a prevention navigator at Trillium Health. Andrew, first, why don't you tell us what that means, what kind of work you're doing for Trillium?
Hi. So I am a prevention navigator here at Trillium. And what I focus on primarily is health insurance and cost for health services here at Trillium, specifically for our PrEP patients, which is meant to prevent HIV infection. And I also look to see for ways for us to get funding to get their medications and lab work covered for free so the patient doesn't have to worry about the cost of their appointment. And then the second half of my job, I do face-to-face interactions with patients and do the beginning of their PrEP appointments before they speak with their provider or doctor to get a renewal of their prescription or start taking the medication.
Everyone handles these infection and everyone handles news differently. But, you know, you're often interfacing with people in pretty sensitive times. How much does your own experience help you in working through these conversations with them, Andrew?
My own experience helps me out 100% every single time I talk to a patient, especially when it comes to their sexual health or HIV prevention or treatment.
So take us through a little bit of your own story and how it's impacted you and inspired some of the work you're doing.
Okay. So my story starts off when I was very young. I was 16 years old at the time that I was diagnosed with HIV. I was diagnosed when I was in high school, and the story behind it is I was running for student body president at the time, and a part of running for president for our school was the do a blood drive through the Red Cross, donate blood, and then we have the rest of the election throughout the rest of the school year. After doing a blood drive for Red Cross, I received a letter in the mail at my house about 2 weeks later, and it simply stated on there that there was an issue with my donation. Please call this number. We'll have a donation counselor speak with you, and from there, steps would be taken. So I called the number. I make sure I hit the letter for my parents. I stepped out of the house so my parents can hear me on the phone. And the person I speak with, we set up a time the following day to meet up and talk about what's going on with my blood donation. Now, before I called, I got on the internet, and I looked up what could be issues with a blood donation. The first thing there on the list is HIV, but then there's a list of other things like West Nile virus and malaria. So I'm on the phone with this woman, and I ask her, is it HIV related? And she tells me she can't tell me. So we end our call, and I'm left to just stick with my own devices and all the bad things I was thinking. And I remember the entire night before and the day before I met up with her, I was wishing that I had malaria or West Nile virus. Wow. And I know that sounds crazy.
It doesn't sound. I understand the point you're making. Wow. Wow.
Yes. So I met with her the next day. I went to the Red Cross from my school, and it was the woman I spoke with on the phone and another woman was with her. They took me to a big room in the Red Cross, and I remember it being very dark and very cold in the room. And the woman who looks and turns to me, she says, yes, you're right, it's HIV. She says it just like that. And she was under the impression that I knew that I was positive at that point, but she didn't know. So when I reacted, I had crazy abandonment. I'm screaming and yelling, and I'm upset, and I'm crying, and I'm crying, and I'm crying. And to touch back something that David said, when I had first found out, it was incredible fear and incredibly scary. At the time, all I had was the reference of people getting HIV back in the 80s and early 90s when it's nothing but bad and there's only death. So I didn't know how to handle this. I couldn't take in the news. And at that moment, they realized I wasn't okay to leave. So thankfully, they did not let me leave. They actually called my high school. My high school guidance counselor came, and she was there, and she was my saving grace. And then they called my parents. And when they called my parents came to the Red Cross. They didn't know what was going on. They had no idea. I couldn't even speak to tell them what occurred. So once it was explained to them that I have HIV, of course, they were crushed. And they didn't know how to react or respond either. So the counseling staff that was there, thankfully, they helped us work through the process of first hearing the diagnosis, and then from there, connecting us with different people to get me into treatment and figure out what we do from there. Because just like me, they assume it's just a death sentence at this point. So what is the point of doing anything? And from there, I was actually connected with AIDS Rochester here in Rochester, and that started my journey to treatment and to getting to undetectable.
Wow. How did your relationship and your conversations with your parents sort of unfold after that initial news?
They changed a lot because at that point, the day they found out I was positive, that was the day that they found out that I was gay, and that was the day they found out that I was having sex. So we had a lot to unpack and talk with everything I was experiencing and going through in my life, because at that point, being gay definitely was something that was not accepted in my family. So that was the first hurdle to get over. And then the next hurdle was helping them come to terms with the fact that just because I'm gay doesn't mean that I deserved to get HIV.
This is totally just not really, I don't know if it's even fair to ask, but I mean, I care about your story, and you have me at the edge of my seat, and I'm just rooting for good things for you. I have to say, Andrew, I hope things have evened out and gotten better with your parents over the years.
Yes, our relationship has definitely grown. Me being HIV positive and going through treatment, it brought us together. My parents were there at my very first appointment, and any time that I had an appointment for the first couple of years, one of them always wanted to be there. They were always talking about new advancements they see in the news or possible treatment and vaccine options that are being worked on. And that just built a stronger relationship for us. And it helped us just dig through all the muck we had already accumulated to get to a good space.
Wow. Remarkable story we're hearing from Andrew Shepherd, a prevention navigator at Trillium Health, on this World AIDS Day 2020. I don't know, Andrew, in some ways, your story reminds me, I mean, I just watched the other night, I watched the new movie Happiest Season. And maybe we should talk about that on Connections at some point. Maybe we'll do that this week. Everybody's talking about this movie, which I spent 3/4 of this movie thinking, this is just a cliche holiday movie. I mean, the protagonist happened to be a lesbian couple, but it's, you know, it's sort of cliche stuff. And then, of course, Dan Levy delivers this killer monologue towards the end that just totally flipped my perspective on everything and made me realize how sort of skewed I view things as someone who is not gay and doesn't have to deal with coming out and how families react and what parents say. But you, Andrew, have to, you know, being 16 years old, your parents on the same day find out you got HIV, you're sexually active, and you're gay. That's an amazing story, and I'm really glad to hear that they were there for you, because you probably work with a lot of people who have a lot of different levels of support, some more than others. Is that fair?
That is fair. I've worked with people who I can tell have a very big support network, and some people, their only support network is me in that room with them in that moment.
Wow. Do you just sort of, I mean, there's not really a formula, right? You just talk to people as human beings and let them know that they're going to be loved and that they're going to be supported by someone, that there will be, and that there are medical services, right? I mean, because you went through this at a very different time. And now, as much as the diagnosis, I'm sure, is frightening for anybody, there's a lot of really good news about what the medical community has been able to do with this, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. I look at from when I was diagnosed to the first appointment where I got medication. And in that appointment, not only was I given one medication, I was given two others. So I was taking three very large pills. And with one of the pills, I was given a warning card. And that warning card said, if you have any side effects or reactions in the below listed groups, if you have two of them, stop taking this immediately and go to an emergency room. So that was a fearful moment for our entire family as soon as we saw that card. And I base it to today now. There are still side effects that can happen with medications, but if I was today being diagnosed, the fear would still be there, but I know that there was so much advancement in technology that I wouldn't be as fearful as I was when I first found out.
Yeah. Is there a most common question you get about it?
How long am I going to live? Anytime I've talked to anybody who, and I've never given somebody an HIV diagnosis at this point in my life, but people that I've connected with and that I speak to in my personal life who know and who have found out, it's how long am I going to live or am I going to die? That is probably the most often thing I'm asked.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like any one of us can answer the question perfectly, but is there a standard way you kind of respond to that when that comes up?
I respond the way that one of the counselors, when I was diagnosed, explained to me, because I told her I don't want to die. And she said to me, people with HIV and AIDS are living 40, 30, 50 years. And I screamed at her, I don't want 30 years. It's not what I want. I want a long life. Mm. And what she said to me in that moment is that your life is not based on years. It's based on the experience, knowledge, and joy you have to pass along to the next person. And I try to stick along that same lines when I talk to people.
Andrew, as we look at Saturday, it's an important day for Trillium. You're a prevention navigator at Trillium Health. Anything you want the community to know about the importance that Saturday night will bring? I mean, it's going to be a fun evening, but it's also an important fundraiser for your organization.
The importance behind it, one, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be fun. But two, this is a moment where if you feel even slightly disconnected or you don't know who you can talk to, where you can go to, what you can do to help, not only would you be benefiting every patient who comes here to Trillium for services and just the place to connect, but you can also establish connections for yourself and get answers to the questions that you may not know or that Google has told you a complete lie about.
Wow. Andrew Shepherd, a prevention navigator at Trillium. Dr. Bill Valenti is with us, the Senior Vice President for Strategic Advancement, the Chief of Innovation, and co-founder and staff physician at Trillium Health. David Henderson is the playwright of Unfinished Business, which you will see in part, at least, on Saturday night as part of this event. And Dr. Valenti, let me get an email from a listener named Amy who says about PrEP discrimination. Amy says, Evan, what's frustrating in our society is that the people that are being responsible on PrEP are discriminated against for life insurance and other purposes related to that industry. Is there any discussion going on to eliminate that sort of discrimination here in New York State?
Yeah, a lot of discussion to destigmatize this and turn this into a sexual health matter and be what we call sex positive in our thinking. So that a lot of the initial hesitation by insurance companies has gone away. There's also state regulation that speaks to this, so you can't get away with it in New York.
Okay, so sounds like at least a better situation here than other places. Is that
correct?
Right? Okay. What are the other big obstacles that you see here, Bill? I ask that because our colleagues at WXXI News have been reporting this week on some of the efforts that that have been made on ending the epidemic. And there's something called 340B that, you know, is a little bit down in the weeds, but can you sum that up for people?
Yeah. There's a piece of the public health law, it's a United States law, that allows certain clinics, pharmacies, to purchase drugs at a discount. The rebate that comes back to the clinic, like Trillium Health, is designed to be used to develop programs, take care of patients, help them with housing, help the patient, turn it back into health care for the patient. There's a movement in the state legislature to change that to, in other words, divert the rebate from the clinic or the pharmacy back to the state health department. In other words, there's about 50 plus million dollars at stake here across New York State. So what it does is it weakens the safety net, because we use our 340B money to subsidize patient care. That's how we get people on PrEP. That's how we help people with housing and urgent needs, those kinds of things, cover things that aren't otherwise covered to get people in care. It's an investment. We make an investment. We invest those dollars in patient care for better outcomes, and that's one of the reasons why we've had success across New York State with this and the epidemic initiative. So now diverting those rebates and sending it back to the health department comes at a very bad time because you're trying to end an epidemic during a pandemic. And what about the people? So, yes, that's a very real problem and needs to be addressed.
What happens next with this then, Bill?
Well, we're making a lot of noise about it and being honest about where the money goes. I mean, people need to understand that and pressure our legislators to do something about this.
I think legislatures across the country are saying we're out of money. I mean, unless the federal government does something, states are out of money, localities are out of money, and the federal government, I just saw a proposal today for a $900 billion new stimulus plan that has some bipartisan support in the U.S. Senate. By the way, for people wondering, it would be nearly $1 trillion without any direct cash relief. So no new checks or stimulus or UBI or anything like that. It's not a done deal yet. But even members of the Senate are saying we can't do anything as big as we did in the spring. There's just not money. What do you say to that, Bill?
Do something. Do something and make an investment in people, because in the end it's going to cost less. If you want to be transactional about it, it'll cost less than having somebody end up in the hospital, die, become homeless, not be able to put food on the table or take care of their children. So, sooner or later we have to come to grips with how we invest those kinds of dollars. And I say prevention is better than treating disease. You know, it's easier to keep a healthy person healthy than it is to make a sick person well.
Well, in our last few minutes then, Dr. Valenti, certainly the work that you're doing and that the entire medical community is doing, it's going to become more, I don't know if compressed is the right word, but there's going to be hard choices. We saw Governor Cuomo announce yesterday that Erie County is not going to do elective surgeries starting on Friday. I mean, the work that you do is generally not elective, but we are seeing an entire medical system strained by rising infection numbers, hospitalizations. And I saw Dr. Ashish Jha from Harvard with a very interesting set of ideas today about who's getting hospitalized with COVID. Because when you look at the hospitalization rates, it's very interesting. For six straight months, it was almost exactly the number of people who were hospitalized was the same percentage. So you could see a certain number of new cases and then just deduce how many hospitalizations would happen based on 6 months of care. Now, that number's fallen almost in half in November. And if you're wondering why, Dr. Jha is saying probably because medical systems across the country have to make decisions on who even has space to hospitalize. And maybe people who would have been hospitalized in September are not being hospitalized in November or December. And that's a very hard thing to think about. Are you worried about the work that all of your colleagues across disciplines in the medical community are going to be doing impacted by COVID, whether that's HIV/AIDS, whether that's other kinds of surgeries, cancer, et cetera? What's the impact that you're fearing, if you're fearing one, Bill?
Well, crisis management. I mean, you can only juggle two or three things at a time. And again, ending an epidemic during a pandemic and dealing with poverty, housing, insurance, and health care all at the same time while we're learning new information about how to take care of a new disease and trying to conquer it quickly. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. So I'm concerned about what we saw early, where in the early days with burnout, fatigue, people leaving the profession, and just not having enough people to get the work done, because in the end, sick people suffer. So it gets back to my earlier message about trying to prevent as much as possible to avoid illness, hospitalization, et cetera, those things down the road. Let's see what we can do up front and prevent.
Well, listeners, you can register for the event on Saturday evening. TrilliumHealth.org to register. The virtual fundraiser marking World AIDS Day 2020 is Saturday, 7 p.m. You can watch it at Channel 1301 in the city of Rochester, but also on the Friends of Trillium Health Facebook page. Dr. Valenti and Mrs. Kasia Davis are going to be hosting it. You're going to be able to check out a preview of the play Unfinished Business and a lot more. And this is such an important event for Trillium if you want to support them in the work that you've been hearing about this hour. Dr. Valenti, it's always a pleasure to hear your voice, the best voice in radio, but I look forward to a time when I can shake your hand or at least see you again. Maybe handshakes will go away, but I'd love to see you again soon. Thank you, Bill.
Anyway, yes.
You got it, sir. That's Dr. Bill Valenti, and I want to thank our other guests as well. Andrew Shepard, what a remarkable story and such important work you do at Trillium. Thank you for the work you do for this community.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to do it, and I'm happy to be here.
And David Henderson, playwright of Unfinished Business, thanks for presenting it for the community, and thanks for sharing these stories this hour.
Thank you.
TrilliumHealth.org. They'd love to have you registered and see you on Saturday night. More connections coming up next.